The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and National Geographic. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. Now, these are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And on today's Armchair Traveler, we'll begin our journey with some cold weather travel. Quite fitting, huh? Well, in the Yukon, minus 35 is perfect weather to get outside. So says the headline for Fiona McGlynn's article. She's a freelance writer who has called Canada's far north home since 2018. Now, her story appeared in the February 2nd, 2004 issue of the New York Times. And we're going to begin with this little subhead written by the editors. In this rugged wedge of northwestern Canada, winter means shimmering northern lights as well as hot soaks, dog sleds, and hair-freezing contest, and you thought you had a bad hair day. Let's go. Frozen hair is a nuisance in most places, but at the Eclipse Nordic Hot Springs in Whitehorse, Yukon, it's a higher calling. Every winter, hundreds of people try to freeze their hair into a troll doll-like coif for a chance to win prizes of $2,000 Canadian. That's about $1,500 US. Now, just in case that doesn't give you goosebumps, Andrew Umbrick, 36, the Hot Springs owner and general manager, has opened a designated snow rolling area to let bathers cool off without banging into the rocks surrounding the pool. "I have to give them a safe place to roll because they're going to kill themselves on those boulders," Mr. Umbrick said. These are the kinds of safety considerations that tend to arise in rugged places like the Yukon, a roughly 186,000-square-mile wedge of northwestern Canada that extends from British Columbia across the Arctic Circle to the Beaufort Sea. Its long winter nights and boreal location make it a prime destination for viewing the northern lights, and with the sun's magnetic field approaching the peak of its 11-year cycle, sending more charged particles into the Earth's upper atmosphere, 2024 could bring the best displays in years. And this is one reason Whitehorse landed on this year's New York Times 52 Places to Go list, and that was for 2024. And they've just released, by the way, their 2025 list, and we'll try to get to that in a future episode of Armchair Traveler. Back to our story. Those long subarctic nights also make for plenty of pent-up energy, which Yukoners let off just as the sun begins to make its resurgence in February with joyous and decidedly offbeat Yukon Rendezvous, a festival in Whitehorse that celebrates its 60th anniversary this year from February 9th to 25th with events like chainsaw chucking and flower packing, not to mention the hair freezing. Destination Canada, the National Tourism Board, has increasingly promoted festivals like Yukon Rendezvous, along with other wintry experiences. While the bulk of travelers visit the Yukon in the summer months, winter visits were on the rise before 2019. After taking a hit during the pandemic, the number of international visits recovered but remained 21% below 2019-2020 levels last winter. Fishnets, feathers, and mittens. In 1988, Luann Baker Johnson, age 64, of Whitehorse, carried 494 pounds of flour for 30 feet to place second in Rendezvous' flour packing contest, a grueling challenge that has its roots in the late 1890s Klondike Gold Rush. Now, Miss Baker Johnson, a glass brewer and owner of Lumel Studios, now makes some of the prizes, including a nearly 3-foot-long glass axe for the festival's competitions. Miss Baker Johnson's daughter, Shanta Ferguson, 31, a Rendezvous champion, threw a chainsaw 32 feet, winning the 2019 women's competition, an event whose appeal will be self-evident to anyone who's ever struggled to start a chainsaw in freezing temperatures. Miss Ferguson and her husband, John Ferguson, 32, run the Gather Cafe and Tap House next door to the glassblowing studio. The menu features fresh local ingredients, no small logistical feat in the remote frozen north where imported produce can look a bit haggard. The Arctic char tacos are served with greens grown hydroponically in nearby shipping containers. People are surprised by the quality and caliber of restaurants up here, Miss Ferguson said. With thousands of people expected to converge on Whitehorse for Rendezvous in the next few weeks, local residents are getting ready. What I love about Rendezvous is that everyone has the opportunity to enter. They can toss logs, throw an axe, chuck a chainsaw, and it doesn't matter if you win a competition or not. It's such bizarre fun, Ms. Baker Johnson said. The territorial government's tourism office provides $100,000 in operational funding to the festival and promotes it in the Yukon Travel website and social media, even offering tips on Rendezvous dress code, typically suspenders, feathers, and other 1890s garb, along with plenty of warm clothing. The last bit is sage advice, as Stephanie Hammond, 49, discovered in 2008-11. Shortly after moving to Whitehorse, when she joined the local roller derby's group float in the Rendezvous parade when the temperatures dipped to minus 35 Fahrenheit. She assumed the parade would be canceled. It wasn't, and was surprised when her team piled into the back of a pickup truck in roller derby costumes, fishnets and all. Ooh, a taste you won't forget. Dog sleds have crisscrossed the far north since long before the days of White Fang, but with the climate change making the snowpack unreliable, dog sled races have run into some difficulties. In 2016, a mild winter in Anchorage forced organizers of the Iditarod, the world's most famous dog sled race, to rely on snow brought in by a train. The year before that, the Babe Southwick Memorial, a dog sled race originally held on the Yukon River during Rendezvous, was relocated because the ice had become unsafe. Rendezvous no longer holds dog sled races. The First Mate Babe Southwick Memorial race continues under different organizers. But there's still plenty of action at the Yukon Quest, a roughly four-day dog sled race from Whitehorse that reaches Dawson City about 6 hours northwest by car on or around February 7th. Now, Dawson City, a major destination for fortune hunters in the 1890s, including Jack London, the author of White Fang, still draws travelers today. The town of about 2,400 is home to Canada's first gambling hall, museums, and other colorful buildings, many of them tilting ominously as the permafrost thaws under their foundations. Warming permafrost is a widespread problem in the Yukon, causing landslides and destabilizing soil. Dawson City residents must occasionally jack up the buildings to keep them level. Dawson City hosts the Thaw de Gras Spring Carnival, March 15th to 17th, a rendezvous-like event where you can cheer on dog sled teams, toss an axe, or watch adults race on tricycles. The town also challenges those with iron stomachs to sample local tradition, the sourtoe cocktail at the Gold Rush-themed Sourdough Saloon. After taking the sourtoe oath, initiates drink a shot of whiskey. Most club members prefer Yukon Jack, the saloon advises, garnished with a preserved human toe. Now, it doesn't count if your lips don't touch the toe. Over the years, the club has acquired 25 toes, all donated, it says in parentheses. Once initiated, you may want to clear your palate at Bon Bon & Company, reservations recommended, a Yukon culinary landmark famous for its house-made charcuterie. After dinner, take in live music most weekends down at the dock of the Westminster Hotel, which locals lovingly prefer to as the Pit. Now, if you're in town between March 28th and 31st, you can watch a movie at the Dawson City International Short Film Festival. The days are especially short in Dawson, a mere 165 miles south of the Arctic Circle. But there are plenty of outdoor activities, such as snowshoeing, the Midnight Dome, a viewpoint overlooking the Yukon Valley and Klondike Valley, and often the only place to catch a few rays of direct sun. And you can hear the quietness. At her home just outside Whitehorse, Tina Dixon, 53, answered the phone for an interview from her night office. It's her hot tub. Oh, wow. She's coming out early to visit us, Miss Dixon said, referring to the green curtains of light waving above. Many indigenous cultures have a special connection with the Northern Lights, Miss Dixon, who is a Chippewan. Described them as returning ancestors. It's our spirit world coming to visit. Ms. Dixon owns and operates Who What Where Tours, a company that not only offers Northern Lights tours, but also takes visitors to the Yukon Wildlife Preserve, where they can ride a bus, walk, or a kick sled, a small self-propelled device, around a 3-mile loop to see northern animals like muskox, bison, caribou, moose, lynx, and Arctic fox in natural landscape. In the Yukon, you can hear the quietness, she said. Visitors who want to learn about the area's indigenous population can tour Long Ago People's Place, a First Nations camp, where they can hear about southern Tuchon territory and culture. In the winter, people want to know how we survive, said the Yukon First Nations member and camp manager, Meta Williams. Imagine what it was like for it to be minus 69 degrees Fahrenheit, she said, living in a brush shelter packed with snow and sprinkled with water. And that was a way to add a layer of insulation from the wind and cold. Indigenous tourism has expanded rapidly in Canada, outpacing the overall growth rate of tourism in the country. The Yukon First Nations Culture and Tourism Association works with 15 to 20 Indigenous tour operators across the territory who offer dog sledding, snowmobiling, ice fishing, and traditional drum making, among other activities. Many First Nations economic development corporations have invested in tourism-related businesses like airlines and hotels. Ms. Williams hopes that visitors leave the Long Ago People's Place with a new understanding of the past. Our history is not all written in books, she said. When we started back in 1995, I had no idea that someday we could truly tell our story and not have somebody tell it to us. She has early memories of her grandparents who lived in the bush year-round, making special trips to Whitehorse for rendezvous. They would be dressed up in their finest beaded and moosehide tan clothing, she said. An antidote to cabin fever. On the eve of the festival's anniversary, rendezvous organizers reflected on how it has changed over the last 6 decades. From adapting to warmer temperatures, they once had to buy snow from the local ski hill for the snow sculpting event, to promoting diversity and inclusivity at events like the Call for the Cup, which has been billed as a search for Yukon's primo male, but it's often open to people of all genders and identities. Rendezvous has changed and evolved while trying to hold on to the traditional side, said the festival's president, Tamara Fisher, who said she also wanted to raise awareness of Indigenous people's participation in the festival. I'm an Indigenous woman, and last year for the program, I wore some of my regalia, she said. I wanted people to know that there are Indigenous people involved. At its heart, the festival remains a time-tested antidote for cabin fever. Yukoners have long known that silly antics are as much a balm for the winter blues as a quiet night watching the wonders of the sky. Just ask Mr. Umbrick of Eclipse Nordic Hot Springs, which hosts the annual hair-freezing contest. Wellness and health are primary focuses at his facility, so even when it gets really cold, he said, guests can be assured no one's ever broken their hair. So there you go. That's something to shoot for one day, huh? Okay. Well, from the ever-chilly Yukon territory, we head to Norway and the Arctic Circle. The New Stars of Polar Science is the article written by Lois Parsley, and it appeared in the December 2024 issue of National Geographic. And as the cover photo caption reveals, and I'm going to read that, as climate research becomes more critical, a small Arctic research station in Norway has emerged as a scientific boomtown. It's a haven for an increasingly female-led contingent of experts doing some of the planet's most important studies, and for the workers who make this life in this demanding place more hospitable. Okay? So, now we're going to read the main article about the What we're going to do is read captions from the photos of the 6 women that are featured here in this article. These are all researchers. And then we're going to read the main article, okay? So first up is Bettina Haup, and she's former station manager, Awapef Arctic Research Base. Now, scientists collect data from polar locations to understand how the world is changing. The weather balloon Haup holds, and that's what the picture is. She's holding this balloon. It carries a radiosonde, an instrument that measures temperature, humidity, and pressure. One is released every day at the Ny-Ellesund Research Station in Svalbard, Norway. Haup says such research is critical to our chances to survive as a species in the long run. Our next researcher is Bodil Hagvik, and she's the community shop manager at Kings Bay. Unexpected items make life at the station easier. Hagvik works for the Norwegian state-owned company, store, supplying residents with toiletries and some essential goods, including warm socks and chocolate. She's holding a baritone horn in this particular picture, an instrument she learned to play as a child and picked up again recently. Instruments Hagvik purchased have made it possible for amateur musicians at the station to play together. And I have to ask myself, how do they keep that brass warm in order to play it? Whew. Next up is Susanna Garcia Espeda. Now, she's the station manager and engineer, Norwegian Mapping Authority. Observing changes on Earth involves looking up at the stars. Espeda stands in the authority's geodetic observatory office in this picture, where scientists are tracking changes in Earth's shape, gravity field, and rotation. These measures help them more precisely monitor sea level rise and ice melt. Next, we meet Charlotte Havermans. Now, she's a marine zoologist from the University of Bremen, Germany. As the Arctic warms, its ecosystems are changing dramatically. Scientists began documenting the presence of helmet jellyfish, a species generally found in more temperate waters near Svalbard, about a decade ago. Haverman stands with a net, and this is what she's doing in the pictures, and she's sampling jellyfish. She uses environmental DNA to detect the animals in the waters off Ny-Alesund and the models after their predicted expansion farther into the Arctic. And then we have Ingrid Gjertstad. Now, she is a research coordinator for the Norwegian Polar Institute. Gjertstad visits Gaspu, a hut about 2 miles outside of Ny-Alesund, with her dog Yukon. Now, the half Malamute, half Husky is also pictured here, a beautiful dog, and she's one of Gjertstad's two dogs. He regularly accompanies her on trips away from the station, though. She notes he is more interested in small birds than polar bears. Even if he's not the best guard dog, she says, Yukon is still the best buddy. And next up is Marie Kosh. Now, Kosh, shown with a sampling net containing sea urchins, is researching how warming waters affect the physiology and feeding behavior of the spiny palm-sized omnivores, a key link in the Arctic food chain. The threat of climate change is ever-present, she says. And in her picture, she's standing on a boulder on the edge of the sea, and it's all covered with ice and snow. And she says the threat of climate change is ever-present, which makes it even more important to understand all the tiny parts of this system. So there you've met all the researchers. Now let's go to the main article of the New Stars of Polar Science. Ny-Alesund, a small international research outpost nestled among the snowy mountains and icy fjords of Svalbard, a Norwegian archipelago in the Arctic Ocean, is one of the northernmost settlements on Earth. During the winter months, it's a frigid and hospitable place where the sun never rises, leaving the community's low-slung buildings bathed in the inky blue darkness of an unbroken polar night. Despite the harsh weather, Svalbard is unmistakably warming, and at an alarming rate, more than 4 times faster than the global average. This has caused unsettling changes to its environment. Take the arrival of helmet jellyfish, thought to have entered these far north Arctic waters about a decade ago. They feed on krill and small fish that native marine life, such as cod and herring, depend on, or the continually warming permafrost, which is threatening to release previously locked-in-place carbon into the atmosphere. In Svalbard, the average air temperature has increased by nearly 7 degrees Fahrenheit since the early 1970s. In Ny-Alesund, it's now just a few degrees below freezing. Last summer, an extreme heat wave led to extensive melting across the archipelago's ice caps. But other shifts are happening in the region, too. Dozens of scientists from over 10 countries continue to deepen our understanding about climate change when it's needed more than ever, and many are women. That's a striking shift for the outpost, where men have historically predominated and haven't always been particularly inviting. Originally founded as a coal mining settlement, Ny-Alesund began its conversion into a research hub in the 1960s after a fatal accident participated in the end of mining operations. Climate scientist Inger Hansen Bauer spent the winter of 1983-84 in Ny-Alesund working for the Norwegian Polar Institute. Now, she remembers the isolation she felt as the only woman in the station. I gradually understood that there was communication between the men, in which I was not a part, and there was no parallel female grapevine. Change, Hansenbauer says, has come incrementally alongside the long overdue rise of more women in science and in areas involving immersive fieldwork. Julia Boyk, a researcher with Berlin's Humboldt University and Alfred Wegener Institute in Potsdam, Germany, was still among the minority when she began collecting data on permafrost in 1998. Last year, however, she looked around and realized that for the first time, her three-person team was entirely women. The work atmosphere has improved, she says, noting better food and general hygiene, but at the same time, their jobs have gotten harder as a result of the climate change they are documenting. Now, rainfall has increased, Boyk says, and the snow cover period has shrunk. Diminishing sea ice means polar bears spend more time on land, making Boyk's field work more difficult. She won't go to her long-standing research site when the predators are nearby. In 2021, photographer Esther Harvath, who specializes in covering scientific expeditions in polar regions, arrived to chronicle the lives of these researchers, hoping to humanize their increasingly urgent work. She began photographing the kind of role model she wished she had as a child growing up in Hungary. I always imagined that I would love to feel this biting cold in my face, Harvath says, but I was a girl. I only saw men doing that. I didn't even dare to dream that one day I would experience it. In these photographs, which we've described earlier, Harvath highlights researchers and staff who make life in the community possible. Each is pictured with something that sustains her or represents her work. So quite an interesting little journey there to a very cold location up north, huh? Well, we're going to head to the American Southwest next to visit a pristine landscape of mountainous western landscape, New Mexico's Gila Wilderness. No cars, no crowds, 100 years of solitude in the New Mexico wilderness. This is by frugal travel columnist Elaine Glusak, and we've had many of her articles in past. And it appeared in the June 12, 2024 issue of the New York Times. And we begin. On a crisp spring morning, I trusted a horse or boy named Sino, a bay named Sino, to show me the vast Gila wilderness of southern New Mexico. Red rock walls rose beside us as we wove back and forth across a shallow creek separating ponderosa pine on the shady south side of Rocky Canyon from barrel cactus in the cliff crevices on the north desert-like north face. Now, I leaned against this neck of Sino, climbed a steep ridge that led to a hilltop savanna of pinyon, jupiner, and groves of tentacled cane choya cactus, tipped in faded yellow fruit. Now, surrounding them, forested mountains were unblemished by buildings or roads. And by the way, cactus fruit is quite tasty and not seen very much, I'm sure, around here in the southern part of the U.S., but if you ever get a chance to try it, it's just not bad. Now, 100 years after it was named the nation's first wilderness area in 1924, the remote Gila wilderness seems to fulfill the vision of its founder, the conservationist Aldo Leopold. By wilderness, Leopold wrote, I mean a continuous stretch of country preserved in its natural state, open to lawful hunting and fishing, big enough to absorb a 2 weeks pack trip and kept devoid of roads, artificial trails, cottages, or other works of man. Henry Provisino, a former district manager for the Forest Service who, until this recent retirement, managed much of the Gila Wilderness, where pine-covered mountains conceal countless canyons and habitats for wolves, bears, and mountain lions. Here, man is only a visitor, he said. Now there are 48 countries in the world with some form of wilderness designation, and it all started right there, or right here. As I discovered over 5 days, visiting Gila, and it is pronounced Gila, is both inspiring and demanding. The wilderness bans inconvenience like cars and bridges, limiting most travel to bikers and horseback riders, and roads nearby are slow, making a remote destination more distant. But it's all by design. And by the way, the reason I mentioned the pronunciation, it's spelled G-I-L-A, but again pronounced Gila. People have to want to come here. The fast pace of a development tied to the boom in road construction with the advent of automobiles already concerned Leopold when he came to southern New Mexico in the early 1900s as a Forest Service supervisor. Among his duties was shooting predators such as wolves to protect their prey for hunters. He realized killing off all predators caused huge problems in the natural balance of things, said Steve Morgan, a retired landscape architect who performs also as Aldo Leopold and lectures throughout the United States. He talked about setting land aside as a land lab so we could study it. In June 1924, the Forest Service acted on his proposal, designating hundreds of thousands of acres as the Gila Wilderness. Over the years, the boundaries have shifted, and now two adjacent wilderness areas roughly cover its original footprint. The larger, nearly 560,000-acre Gila Wilderness kept the original name beside the neighboring 202,000-acre Aldo Leopold Wilderness. Both are surrounded by the Gila National Forest, a 3.3-million-acre buffer that is less restrictive in terms of access, which includes allowing cars. The mountainous region can be hard to navigate. I staged my visit with day trips from two towns that border the National Forest, tiny Kingston, New Mexico, about 190 miles southwest of Albuquerque, and Silver City, 45 miles west of Kingston, on a highway so steep and winding that many trucks have to take a 110-mile detour. People have to want to come here, said Maribeth Peckott, a public affairs officer for the Forest Service, who manages both the Gila National Forest and the Gila Wilderness. You don't stumble across it, she said. The Gila region's top attraction, the Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument, is a good place to start exploring. From Silver City, the Cliff Dwellings are a 90-minute drive north on Kirby Highway 15, which winds through the National Forest. Beginning around 1276, hunter-gatherers known as Mongolian people built a series of 40 rooms into caves among amber-hued cliffs on rock known as Gila Conglomerate. To me, it's our church, said Ronnie Caccini of the Pueblo of Zuni, one of the Pueblo cultures believed to descend from the Mongolian and related people, in a video played at the monument's visitor center. I hiked the steep trail of nearly 300 steps to reach the dwellings in time to catch a tour with a park ranger who described how a drought had likely drawn the Mongolian to the cliffs above the spring-fed creek. Nearby, at the Lower Scorpion campground, a gallery of pictographs filled a rock wall with abstract figures and symbols, their meanings lost to time. From the monument, a number of trails venture into the Gila Wilderness, leading to slot canyons and backcountry hot springs. But conditions, including the prospect of fording the swift Gila River in spring, kept me in the front country. Now, there just south of the cliff dwellings, I heeded the signs around the rustic pools at Gila Hot Springs Campground to soak and exhale amid views of towering cliffs beside the river. And as she continues to report in her article, and it's a very lengthy article, and we're only going to read excerpts today, she talks about countless tales of lost hikers and then encountering with poison oak and arduous river crossings, among other things. And there's the catwalk recreation area. This offers relatively convenient access to the wildlands that are just beyond it and where continuing construction is going on even today. Well, that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's edition of Armchair Traveler. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's one word, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.